Chapter 32. Out of the Dark. Kolsko House. The site was incongruous, and one that few people could have imagined 2 years ago. 2-year-old Morwenna Walston, Gwenyd's daughter, laughing as she pretended to ride a horse, was actually rocking up and down on one of Carnegie Poovy's large legs. The little girl's delight in her mount's doting visage made Yosef look in amusement to Y4 Kales, sitting next to him. Even Kales's normally jaded nature softened at the sight, although Yosef wasn't sure whether it was the influence of Kales's wife Tina, who sat next to Y4 on the veranda and had a hand on her husband's shoulder. "Tina Kales is not tiny," was Yosef's thought when first meeting her. Slightly taller than her husband and 40 pounds heavier, Tina was a match for the wiry and disreputable Y4. A widow who had owned and operated a bakery in Abersford before the couple moved to Kernford, she immediately opened another bakery and was by all accounts an immediate success. She brooked no nonsense and could sound gruff, but was kind in a way that no one could pretend. Yosef wondered how they'd gotten together and what exactly their mutual attractions were. But as for their bond, there was no question. A week earlier, Kales had been hesitant about the invitation to attend Mara's birthday dinner, initially trying to excuse himself as not being a family member. Yosef had launched into reasons why Kales should come, when Mara settled the issue by telling Kales he was coming and his wife was invited too. Kales deferred his objections when Mara said she'd stop by Tina's bakery to be sure the couple attended. Not that Mara felt enthused about Yosef inviting all three of his shadows. Carnegie she liked, but Kales didn't fit into social situations, and Balwis made her uneasy. She was never sure exactly who he was and how he would react to anything. Yosef's insistence and his pointing out the advantages of making the men protecting him, her, and Aeneas feel welcome and appreciated needed no further exposition. As for the largest babysitter on Cadellium, Carnegie revealed his tolerance when Gwyneth's toddler first favored him as a climbing target. Everyone present felt nothing short of shock to realize that the big man wasn't just tolerant, but he enjoyed the little girl's attention, to the worry and then bemusement of her mother. Yosef completed the adult foursome sitting on the veranda as he rocked a sleeping Aeneas. Yosef and Carnegie had volunteered to free up space and mothers while they prepared the dinner. The only image that marred the scene was the armed guard standing 30 feet away, near the door to the enclosed porch. He held his musket by the barrel, the stock on the ground, and his attention alternated between the darkness around the house and the sight of Carnegie playing with Morwenna. The headman's family had arrived half an hour ago and was being entertained in the great room. As Mara updated her parents on details about finishing their new home, such as curtains, to her mother's interest and her father's disinterest, Anand and Merid watched Miramel breastfeed her 7-month-old daughter Dwina and waited for a turn to hold the baby. Seinwin Keelan had just asked Balwis Preddy why his last name was Preddy, if he wasn't a member of the Preddy Hetman's family. The latter concerned Mara, considering her view of Balwis. It puzzled her at the same time, because Balwis studiously refused to talk about his past, yet continued to sit and dodge Seinwin's probes, instead of stomping out of the room mumbling to himself, as she'd witnessed him do more than once. Seinwin was 20 Anyar years old and had had several visits from potential suitors. Her perpetual spiteful and put-upon manner had mellowed since Mara's wedding. Supporting her parents' belief, she had resented the older sisters not yet being wed, believing it blocked her path. She had inherited more of her father's looks, to her chagrin, as opposed to her three sisters, who more resembled their mother. In her mind, she needed as much time as possible to find a husband. She couldn't be convinced that as a headman's daughter, there would be no dearth of suitors. In contrast, Anad Keelan was by any criteria a beautiful young woman, 17 Anyar years old, of kindly and cheerful disposition. And until recently, she had been the family member most able to stay close to Sinwin. College and Breda laughed between themselves that in another year or two, when Anna was of age for suitors, they would need to improve the roads to Keelan Manor to handle the traffic. The Kolsko cook, Cirrus Clithrow, was a whirlwind in the kitchen, moving between the large stove and the island cutting table and shouting orders to the knight's assistants, Gwened, Honorind, and Norlin Rumney, the 15-year-old servant at Keelan Manor. Norlin had been volunteered by Breda Keelan to help with the evening's chores. His father ran the Keelan stable, and his mother washed and cleaned the manor and the guest cottages. Gwened served as a second cook under Cirrus's direction, while Honorind and Norlin chopped, stirred, set the dining table, and carried out tasks to get ready for the 13 people to be fed at Mera's birthday dinner, not counting the three to be fed by their mothers, two at breasts, and one with her own small plate, as she sat on Gwened's lap. The three guards who accompanied the Keelan family would not sit for dinner, but Cirrus had already taken sandwiches and water to them at their posts, with a promise of more once the formal dinner started. Cirrus herself wouldn't eat with the others, despite Mera's insistence, only to find out there was one person more stubborn than herself. Cirrus said she couldn't do her job properly if she sat at the table and constantly jumped up and ran back and forth to the kitchen. Mera settled for Cirrus agreeing to partake in the birthday cake, a custom that Yosef had discovered seemed to be universal, no matter where humans landed. Usul cursed when Driftwitch fell for the fourth time, as they moved single file along a game trail leading near the Kolsko estate.
"Did we really have to bring that clod along?"
he hissed into Havan's ear.
I wanted to be sure he didn't scurry off at the slightest noise he heard, like a skittish coney. He can help gather the horses and saddles once we're finished with the target. I saw no reason for him to have a firearm, so I assured him your men would take care of that part of the night.
I guess I should be grateful he's unarmed, said Usul. He'd be more a danger to us than any man or woman he faced.
Havant only grunted, to which Usul responded in kind.
How do you know he won't run as soon as we're out of his sight and the firing begins? Do you really think he could find his way back to your camp and the wagons? He can't show up in Salford if he's missing two wagons, and I made sure he didn't bring the escape bags I know he's prepared. They're back in Salford. Don't worry, he'll stay hidden, pissing himself until it's over. Anyway, I'll keep an eye on him, since I won't be going to the house until you signal it's all clear.
Usul understood that the assault itself was not Avant's responsibility, though he suspected the agent could well take care of himself in a fight. Avant's duties were gathering information, helping to plan the attack, getting them to the target, and then identifying the headman's body. Mera opened the main door and leaned out.
Everything all right out here?
Fine, answered Yosef.
Anis is still sleeping, and I'm starting to wonder who will tire of horse riding first, Carnigan or Morwena.
Mera laughed, shaking her head.
Maybe we need to get the two of you to help with the babies more often.
Providing riding instructions and serving as a climbing object are as far as I go, rumbled Carnigan. More intimate tasks I leave to women. I'd rather be fighting the Baldorians.
Morwena was in the middle of toilet training, and everyone was astounded that Carnigan could become even redder than his normal ruddy complexion when, a 6 day ago, Morwena had asked him to take her to the voiding room attached to the house. He had declined and hurriedly found Gwened, who compounded his discomfiture by cackling as she led Morwena away by the hand.
How much longer until we eat? Asked Yosef.
Until Cirrus says it's ready.
I was already told this is the one day I can't give her instructions.
Since you men have the babies under control, I'll leave and get back to my family. And no, Tina, we've got things organized inside. Relax. First-time guests shouldn't be put to work. Don't worry. Next time you visit me, we'll make up for today.
Kaelsa's wife had been about to offer, for the third time, whether she could do anything to help. She had brought an impressively large decorated birthday cake, prepared in her bakery at the suggestion of Cirrus, who had had no issue handing off the cake, so she could focus on the other courses.
Havant stopped and crouched when he caught the first glimpse of lantern light from a window. Like a caterpillar whose rear segments sequentially took fractions of seconds to react, the 21 men behind him halted and did likewise.
"That's it," whispered Usul.
"Yeah,"
said Havant, in a voice lighter than Usul's whisper. 300 yards
away. The brush and trees will only provide cover for another 200 yards. Then it's more open, with a few scattered trees, fences, and some outbuildings. Too bad there's no cloud cover tonight, but Hedan will be completely set in about another 10 minutes.
The larger of Anyar's two moons hung over the western hills, just touching the treetops.
Havant leaned closer to Usul.
"Another 100 yards and I'll check the front of the house to see how many wagons and horses are out front and confirm how many people we can expect inside. I'll also spot the locations of guards with static positions. I won't account for any guards who roam, so be aware. If all seems in place, you can proceed."
Breda Keelan put a hand on Mera's arm.
"Dear, the house is coming along beautifully. I can see for myself why you're thrilled with it."
Breda gave the arm a squeeze.
"And with your family and life, I'm so happy for you. You know how your father and I worried about you."
Mera patted her mother's hand.
"No one's more surprised than me at how much I enjoy being domestic.
Me, Mera Keelan. Picking colors of curtains, shopping for just the right ceramic flower pots for the back patio, and proudly showing a Neos off to anyone even slightly interested. Oh, it's not all giddy. Changing Aeneas and walking him when he cries are no more fun than when I saw you with Honored and Merit.
Though somehow that fades when I feed him, wash him, or when he just sleeps in my arms."
"Any lingering regrets at how all this ties you down?" asked Breda.
Mera nodded.
"There's still some of that, and I assume there always will be. But I manage to spend half my time at work outside the home, even if it's with Aeneas attached to me. I know how fortunate I am to have so much reliable help. Honorind is wonderful with Aeneas, and Gwennet is a devil for getting things done. Cirrus handles most of the kitchen, and Miramel seems unable to sit and do nothing if she's not feeding her daughter or Aeneas.
I saw all the help you had, and I might have even more. I'm only just coming to appreciate mothers who have to do it all on their own."
"Another 10 minutes, a voice called out from the kitchen.
"That's Cirrus," said Mera. "I'll give it 5 minutes and retrieve Aeneas from Yosef and tell the others in back it's about time to eat."
A low-pitched whistle alerted Usul. He replied, and a moment later Havant appeared out of the darkness.
"They're all there, although there might be a couple more than we expected, judging by the horses in front."
"A couple," said Usul.
"What does that mean?
2 for sure or more?"
"Probably 2,
asserted Havant.
"Nothing this many men can't handle."
"I don't doubt we can handle that many, but I don't like surprises."
"I'd hardly call this a surprise,"
uttered Havant, not hiding his irritation.
"We always know any plan is only that, a plan. Not an edict direct from North."
Havant brought the conversation back to the mission before Usul could respond.
"I spotted 3 outside guards in fixed positions, 1 each at the front and back main doors. There's also a 3rd out from the road at the entrance of the lane leading to the house. A 4th guard is walking the grounds. He seems to take the same route each round and takes about 10 minutes to complete a circuit. You can take care of those 4 first, and the rest will be easy."
"Easy is never a word I use on operations like this," until my men and I are back in our own territory, said Usul.
The strike team leader turned to two senior men crouched behind him.
Nedam, take 6 men and work around to the front of the house. Leave one at the west side of the house so no one gets out a window. Leave another man waiting for the guard at the road to come running. After he eliminates the guard, he's to rejoin you. Wait until you hear the rest of us at the rear of the house, then go in the front door. Arkol, you'll have 7 men. You'll take care of the walking guard. Wait until he's out of sight of the house and be quiet about it. Send 1 man to the east side of the house to stop anyone from getting out a window on that side. I'll leave it up to you when to start off the assault on the house. Get as close as you can, then kill those on the back veranda and rush inside. I'll follow with the other 4 men. If you have little or no resistance, we'll follow you. Otherwise, we'll go in the windows on the right side of the house. Havan's diagrams show a dining room and a large room where we might expect people to have congregated. We can't tell exactly where they'll be, since we can't approach close enough to see in windows without being detected, so we'll rely on speed and shock. We'll be at them from 2 or 3 sides, and there can be no hesitation. We have to be in and finish as quickly as possible. Kill everyone who can be a witness. That doesn't include babes too young to speak. We're not savages.
The missing details about how to know in split seconds whether a child was speaking or not amused Avant. He knew any baby would be fortunate to survive this night, especially since the team's final act would be to set the house ablaze. This was war, even if no armies of tens of thousands faced each other. Non-combatants died, whether intentionally or not. And he didn't feel squeamish about the reality.
Should be about ready to eat, declared Yosef. Although someone I'm holding already ate, and unless I'm mistaken, he shit. Even if he's asleep. Time to give him back to his mother or one of the other women.
He wouldn't have dared make such a comment in his previous life, for fear of the PC police, but equal parenting details hadn't yet developed on Kedalium. Yosef gently stroked the soft skin of Aeneas's leg. There was nothing quite like the feel of a newborn skin. He listened to the baby's breathing and watched the little belly rise and fall in the natural abdominal breathing that most older children quit after adults mistakenly told them breathing should be out of the chest. Aeneas's breathing was so quiet. Yosef lowered his ear nearer. Then, the effort to listen carefully made him realize something was missing. That's odd, he said to no one in particular. I don't know if I've ever not heard the Nyklons after dark. The cricket-sized and sounding Unyarian insect analogs were ubiquitous on Kedalium, even at higher altitudes. Although several species had adapted to different environs, they all sounded the same to Yosef, and they were always present. Until now.
What? Said Kale, sitting up sharply in his chair, his wife's hand slipping off him by a sudden movement.
What did you say?
Yosef shifted Aeneas in preparation for standing, still with an ear cocked at the night.
I was just thinking, I don't remember ever not hearing Nyklons as soon as it gets this dark.
Carnegie's hoarse imitation instantly ceased to Morwena's complaint. Yosef heard the big man's chair creak as he shifted his weight.
Nobody move quickly, said Kales, his voice low, tight, and urgent. Act normal, but one by one, get up and go in the house. Keep talking loud about anything, like we were doing.
What?
Started Tina, but Kales put a seemingly casual hand in her arm to stop her from speaking. Yosef could see her flesh turn white with the pressure.
Nyklons don't stop making noise unless there's something or someone they sense as danger. I don't hear anything in any direction. It may be nothing. Or it might be something is out there or someone. You need to get into the house and caution the others.
Now!
For the last word was whispered, the urgency shouted. Yosef's breath caught in his throat for a second. His heart rate shot up, and he clutched the baby against his chest.
Easy. Easy.
Soothed Kales in a whisper, as he rose, pulling his wife to her feet but keeping his grip on her arm.
I think it must be time to eat soon, he said aloud. You all might as well go in. I'll be in a minute.
He walked his wife to the door into the enclosed porch. Kales opened the door and guided Tina through, and the others followed. Yosef reached the door last. On the way, he heard Kales tell the guard they needed to check the grounds and for the guard to follow him 30 feet behind. When Yosef got to the door, he hesitated and whispered,
Do you really think it's anything, Y4? What if it is? You're unarmed.
Kales grinned his are-you-shitting-me look, which Yosef recognized. Kales opened his coat a few inches with the hand not holding the door. And Yosef glimpsed a pistol stock in a holster fastened to the inside of the coat and two knife sheaths. Kales let the coat close and nodded Yosef inside. Yosef held Aeneas tight, his throat muscles tight, his mind racing from an idyllic mood to incipient panic.
No, 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 this can't be happening,
desperately exploded in Yosef's head. As unbidden, he remembered attempts earlier on the Stenton Hewell Hetman.
Kales must be just an alarmist. Please, God, let him just be imagining danger.
Arkol quietly grunted. The people sitting outside were going in. Another minute, and they'd have had them like practice targets. He glanced behind at Usul, whose shrug was visible by starlight.
No matter, Arkol thought. Outside or inside won't make any difference in the end. Now they'll just be bunched together.
At the front of the house, all Niram knew was that he and four men were almost in position to rush the main door. One man carried a shotgun and another an axe, both to ensure that any door they needed to go through wouldn't stop them. He had dropped one man at the side of the house to block that escape route for the Hetman, and a final man had crept to within 40 yards of the guard at the road. In another few minutes, Niram expected to hear the chaos start as Arkol and Usul launched their assault on the rear of the house. That would be his signal. Inside the foyer, Yosef crossed to the front door and opened it. The front guard turned at the sound. The man had a questioning look, caused by Yosef's expression and Carnegie pulling weapons harnesses off a high shelf.
Sir, listen carefully, said Yosef. Count to 10, then come inside. Do you understand?
Why?
No questions. Just do as I say. Once you're inside, wait and listen for anything happening outside. I'll be right back.
Yosef turned and Carnegie tossed him Kales' harnesses.
Get armed.
Even without the weapons Kales had on him, the harness was so heavy Yosef almost dropped it. It took him 5 seconds to set Aeneas on the floor, jam his arms through the harness straps, cinch the belt, and pick Aeneas back up before the baby responded to being dumped on the floor. Carnegie had somehow donned his own harness without setting Morwina down. Although Carnegie's harness had fewer weapons than the others, the size of the pistols and the blades more than made up for the fewer number. Carnegie leaned Kales' musket against the wall, keeping his own and Balwiss's under his arm. Under other circumstances, the sight of the huge man, decked out like a cartoon pirate, holding a 2-year-old in the crook of the same arm that held Balwiss's harness, the other arm holding two muskets, would have been amusing. In these circumstances, it was terrifying. Yosef followed Carnegie thundering down the hall. Carnegie stopped at the door leading to the kitchen and tossed Balwiss's harness at Yosef.
Get Balwis! I'm giving more wiener to Gwennet and getting the people in the kitchen away from the doors and windows and killing the lights. Then you or Balwis get back to the front door.
As he caught the harness, Yosef caught a glimpse through the door into the kitchen, where Cirrus and Honoran stared at Carnegie rushing into the room. Then Yosef reached the great room. 8 seated faces turned to him. They had heard commotion and were just responding. The questioning or surprised expressions immediately changed to other emotions.
Everyone,
Yosef enunciated carefully and loudly enough to get their attention without yelling. Get up, put out the lanterns, and come toward the hall away from the windows. It's probably nothing. We're only being cautious. Kales thinks someone might be out behind the house. He and the back guard have gone to check.
How do you know someone's out there? Demanded Kullage.
God damn it, I don't know. Better to look foolish than take a chance. I noticed the Nyklons quit sounding off. You tell me. When do the noisy buggers ever shut up? Kales is concerned enough to check it out.
The Nyklons are quiet only if they're startled or afraid, said Mera,
running to Yosef and taking Aeneas. Balwis had rushed to Yosef and grabbed his harness.
I'll ask the front door guard to also check the grounds, said Kullage, turning to head down the hall.
Wait, Kullage, said Yosef.
I've asked him to come inside and station in the foyer, just in case. It's less exposed than standing out front.
Just in case of what? Exclaimed Breda.
Honored and Merid, holding hands, stood behind their mother. Before Yosef could give another reassurance that there was probably no problem, a series of shots sounded from behind the house, followed by cries. In a moment of chaos, exclamations threatened to overcome the group before Kullage yelled, Quiet! Put out the lanterns, then do as Yosef says and move away from the windows. Drag furniture over here. He pointed to the interior wall of the room. Kullage looked at Yosef.
We're unarmed!
Yosef gave Kullage one of Kales' pistols and a knife to a pale-faced Mera, who held Aeneas. Balwis gave one of his two knives to Seinwin, standing next to him. They heard another musket shot and shouts from outside the front of the house.
I'm going back to help the guard at the foyer, said Yosef, giving Mera and Aeneas a look.
He ran down the hall again. As he passed the kitchen door, he could see that Carnegie had upended a table that Gwennet now crouched behind, cradling Morwena. Cirrus held a meat cleaver. The teenage boy Norlin grasped one of Carnegie's pistols in both hands. He needed 2 to hold the small cannon in aim. An Honorend brandished a carving knife. At the end of the hall knelt the guard, watching the front door intently. They heard voices, then feet on the wooden veranda steps.
Quick! To the other side!
Yosef told the guard, grabbing Kales' musket. He knelt where the guard had been. If anyone unfriendly came through either the front door or the door into the rear enclosed porch, the 2 of them wouldn't be concentrated in the same place, and the intruder would face fire from 2 directions. Ursul had watched the people sitting on the back veranda rise and start into the house. Too bad, he thought. We could have eliminated them first. With 3 of the men gone right away, the rest of the attack would have been almost anticlimactic. He wasn't worried until one of the 3 men didn't go inside but spoke to the guard. Then the 2 of them walked down the stairs and toward the spot where Ursul and the other 11 men waited.
No problem, whispered the man next to him. We'll take care of them.
The man and 3 others slunk away, spreading out in the direction of the 2 approaching men. Ursul watched, not quite holding his breath, uneasy with the wrinkle in what had started as a stealthy approach to the house. He watched the 2 men get closer, then...
What?
Where was the first man, the one walking ahead of the other by 20 or 30 feet? The lights from the house helped backlight the 2 men. The rear man, the guard with the musket, was still visible, but the other smaller man, where had he gone? In an instant, all plans at stealth disintegrated.
Y4 Kales trusted his instincts. Not to say they hadn't proved wrong a time or two, but listening never hurt. Better mistaken than dead. The silence of a throng of annoying pests was not as significant to him as an intuition he recognized. A summation of too many years and too many situations where the slightest signal was too important to miss. From the veranda and before Yosef had said anything about the missing Nyklon chorus, had he seen a flicker of movement in the starlight? Had there been a faint clink of metal that could have been a window latch or an echo from the kitchen? He didn't know the answers, didn't think about knowing them, and didn't care. All he knew was that every nerve ending was reaching out into the night. Kales was 100 feet from the house when he morphed from a walking man to a wraith. He dropped to the ground as boneless and casually as oil slipping down a glass surface, then moved silently on fingertips and boot toes. To the men watching, it was as if Kales had disappeared. One man was only 12 feet away when his target vanished. His surprise lasted only 10 seconds before the corner of his eye caught an almost imperceptible movement and a coldness stroked his throat. An urge to say something was stifled by the warm flush that bubbled from his lips and the hot flood running down his chest. He rose to his feet, only to fall face forward. 8 feet away, another man was shocked to see his companion stand. What? Flashed through his mind. The next moment, a blade plunged upward, under his rib cage, through his diaphragm and into his heart. The blow prevented his lungs from expelling air, so he couldn't shout. It killed him that instant, though it took another 20 seconds for the rest of his jerking body to capitulate. A third man had turned from seeing the first man rise and fall, and he became the first to see Kales after his disappearance. He fired his shotgun at a blur moving toward him, gratified to see the blur being smashed to the ground. Yet he didn't live to identify what he had hit. The flash from a pistol was his last sight before the ball hit his left eye. Kales felt a terrible blow to his left side. His arm didn't work, but blackness waited to overtake him, just long enough for him to pull his single pistol at the man, illuminated by his own shotgun flash. The guard following Kales saw the two flashes, the larger of the shotgun and the smaller of the pistol. The first bright flash appeared too suddenly and not in the field of view he directly faced. The second flash came when he had focused his attention where the first flash originated. It revealed men, many men, two only 30 or 40 feet away. He only needed to turn his leveled musket a few degrees to fire at the closest man. His bulk struck the crouched man 6 inches below his right nipple, breaking a rib and coursing through his liver and intestines. The guard didn't see anything else. After 3 of the 4 musket balls fired at him, ended his life. Usul might have cursed to himself at the loss of his team's surprise advantage, or because Arkol, the man to lead the initial assault at the rear of the house, was down, dead, or wounded, but he had no hesitation about the appropriate action.
"That's it!" he yelled to the 7 men who still functioned. "We'll chuck our wounded on the way out, spread out, and hit the house at doors and windows."
He hoped that he and the 11 other men at the rear of the house could burst through the back doors and be inside before the people knew they were coming. That hope was gone. The only option left was to hit this house as fast as possible and at as many points as they could, to prevent a concentrated defense. What worried him more than the loss of surprise was that 4 of the men now racing toward the house had empty muskets. Among their 8, they now had only 2 loaded muskets and 2 shotguns. After that, they'd have to attack with pistols and steel. The 5 men at the front heard the firing at the rear of the house and took it as the signal to go in. Nidham, the leader, gave the order.
"At the front door. Munkun, you're first. Try the door. If it's locked, use your shotgun. Tunkel,
If the shotgun doesn't get the door open, use your axe and get us inside. Let's go!
Yosef's heart pounded as if about to burst from his chest. He hyperventilated, his breath coming in gasps. He heard sounds, low voices, then louder, then feet on wooden steps on the floor of the front veranda. Light from the single lantern on the veranda and from a hall lantern still flickering after the attempt to turn it off gave enough light for him to see the door latch quiver, as if someone were checking the mechanism. Despite Yosef focusing all of his senses on the door, the shotgun blast that took out the lock and left a 6-inch hole left him frozen for several seconds. A fortuitous delay. The door kicked open, and a man with a short musket leaped through, only to be hit by a musket ball the guard fired from the opposite side of the foyer. Two more flashes and cracks came from outside, the flames and smoke pouring through the door jamb. The guard was flung backward as both balls hit him, one on a shoulder, the other on a hip. As he reached to pull the pistol from his belt, a third shot struck him in the chest. A man stepped through the door, slipping sideways against the wall, watching the fallen guard. Dressed all in black, he wore a cloth over most of his head, leaving only eyes, nose, and mouth showing. The man didn't see Yosef crouched only 7 feet away, so close that the flame from Yosef's musket hit the man's chest. Yosef didn't watch as the man briefly stood straight against the wall, then slid slowly down, leaving a trail of blood on the wall from the exit wound. Yosef didn't notice because he was busy. As soon as he fired the musket, he dropped it and pulled out one of Kales's pistols in time to shoot a third man who tried to enter the door. The man pitched back onto the veranda. A fourth man fired into the foyer, missing Yosef but causing him to fire back with the last of Kales's pistols. He didn't see whether he'd hit anything and cursed at himself for firing without a clear target. He was now down to two knives on Kales's harness. Yosef listened for more men. He thought he heard two voices, then steps running away, down the veranda toward the great room wing of the house. He was about to run after them when an axe crashed through the lock on the enclosed porch's outer door. He had locked it on the way in, but realized, with a jolt, that he hadn't locked the next door, from the porch to the foyer. He stood 6 feet away from the door. His split second of indecision ended as sounds of many feet and much cursing came toward the unlocked door. Later, he had no clear explanation for his next act. He pulled pistols from the two fallen attackers and jumped into the hall that led to the bedroom wing of the house. Once again, he seemed to have inane thoughts of the most stressful times. The one that popped into his head now was vindication. Mara and everyone else had expressed puzzlement and doubt when he'd insisted that the two halls leading from the foyer to the two wings of the house should not be straight but angled differently in their first 12 feet. When the house had been under construction, he'd stood in the framework and felt uneasy that from one end of the main hall in the bedroom wing, he had a clear line of sight to the great room. Although he couldn't articulate why it bothered him, he'd insisted on the angle change. This made it impossible to see down the hall more than 15 feet in either direction from the foyer. He ducked around the angled corner as he glimpsed men rush into the foyer. Usel was the second man to the foyer. He didn't need to be first in case someone was waiting. He'd served his time being first through doors or point on patrols. The only thing waiting were three bodies. He cursed aloud, there being enough din elsewhere not to bother suppressing his disgust. In the dim light, he could see that two of the bodies were his men. The third was one of the guards. Another of his men lay sprawled motionless on the front veranda. He looked around. Who the hell designed this house and these weird hallways? Avant didn't say anything about this. Shouts, screams, and gunfire drew his attention in the direction of the great room, the kitchen, and the dining room, where they assumed most people would have gathered. This way, He pointed, and they moved. Carnegie and Norlin had the only firearms in the kitchen. The three women crouched behind the heavy wooden table Carnegie had overturned. All three held knives or cleavers. Sounds came from all directions, down the hall in the great room. Then the kitchen door to the outside crashed inward as its lock gave way from a kick. Carnegie had left one lantern on low enough to see someone coming in. A man dressed all in black dove into the room, hit the floor, and rolled behind a counter. Carnegie held his fire, but Norlin shot at the figure, missing by 2 feet and losing his grip on the huge pistol. Another man stepped in, exposed partway through the door, and fired a shotgun into the room, spraying both Carnegie and Norlin. Carnegie was hit several times but hardly flinched, as a 1-inch ball from his pistol took off the top half of the man's head. Carnegie glanced to the side. Norlin lay back on a countertop, blood seeping from 3 hits to his chest and 1 to his throat. Honorand jumped up and pulled the boy down to the floor. He gasped, choking on his own blood, and a frothy red puddle pooled on his chest. Honorand held her hands paused above the boy, not knowing what to do first. She looked at Carnegie. He shook his head. Carnegie heard windows breaking in the dining room next door and shouts and shots from the great room, but he couldn't move yet. The other black-clad man still lurked in the room. Carnegie couldn't leave the women in Morwena. In desperate need to both protect those in the kitchen and go help the others, Carnegie ducked down to the women.
Throw every pot and pan you can get your hands on toward the other side of the room, now!
Gwyneth set Morwena on the floor and joined Honorand and Cirrus in grabbing anything metal and throwing it from behind the overturned table. When the first one hit, Carnegie ran out and dove over the counter that the other attacker had disappeared behind. As Carnegie cleared the countertop, the man spun from 6 feet away and fired his pistol. The ball hit Carnegie's upper left arm, momentarily shocking him. As the man threw away his pistol and drew a hatchet, Carnegie moved faster than a man his size should be able to. He grabbed the man's knife arm with the hand of his unwounded arm. With a wrench, he dislocated the man's elbow. Then a big fist broke his jaw and drove a splinter of bone into the man's brain. His arm was on fire, but he had no time to deal with it. He could hear firing and shouts in the hall in the great room. He pulled another knife and ran to the dining room, not noticing that Cirrus and Honorand followed him. The sounds coming from the east wing of the house panicked Yosef more than thoughts of his own safety. Mera and Aeneas hid in the great room where the group of black-clad men headed. Yosef peeked around an angled corner. He couldn't see the four men. He raced across the foyer and peered around the next corner. The four men had their backs to him. They faced down the hall. One of them fired a pistol, then dropped it, and all four, with blades and hatchets in hand, rose to rush the great room. Yosef ran after them. From 20 feet away, he pulled the trigger on one pistol. There was only a spark, a misfire. Without pausing, he dropped the pistol and grabbed a knife with the same hand. He pulled the trigger on the second pistol. It fired, and one of the attackers went down. He dropped the second pistol and drew another knife as he reached the three men. He felt more scared than he had during the raid on St. Sidran's. There, he had taken cover behind a barricade alongside other defenders, including Carnegie and Dennis. Here, it was only him. In the second before he reached the men, it flashed through his mind not to think, but to let his reactions take over, as chaos had drilled into him during those bruising sparring sessions. As the three men turned, he stabbed one in the side and pushed the man into the others. For endless minutes, or in reality, a few seconds, it was a deadly dance of slashing steel, dodging and ducking. He later couldn't remember exactly what happened, But suddenly, he stood alone. Three of the men on the ground, one groaning, the other two silent, the fourth man running through a door to a side room. Yosef followed, only to see the man push another man back who was about to climb through a broken window. The man Yosef chased leaped out the window and vanished. As abruptly as it had begun, the firing ceased, but not the shouting and crying. Yosef ran down the hall, glancing into the kitchen and seeing only Gwened holding Morwina, the same knife still in her hand. Both looked okay. At the hall doorway to the great room lay a sideboard that had been shoved across the opening. Yosef slid over it and into the room. The only light came from a single lantern turned low. Carnegie was stamping out a small fire from a lantern hit by a firearm. People lay or knelt everywhere. Balwas held his hand to Sinwin's face. Mera held Aeneas and Dwina, Miramel's daughter. Mera's face was streaked with tears. Breda Keelan sat holding her daughter Anid, with Kulich's arms around them both, one of his legs a bloody mess below the knee. To his left, a woman lay face down, not moving. Yosef couldn't see the face, but by her shape and clothing he recognized Miramel. Next to her knelt Tina, holding one of Miramel's hands.
"Is it over?" Balwas called out. "I don't know," answered Yosef.
With the first words he'd spoken since directing the front guard to move to the other side of the foyer. In the intervening time, no more than 2 minutes, he'd killed 5 men. He realized he didn't feel sick at the thought. Instead, he felt as if his blood were on fire as he looked around for someone else to kill. 3 black-clad bodies lay in the room. One had his head turned almost backward, Yosef assumed from an encounter with Carnegie. Another had a kitchen cleaver in the back of his head, the same or similar cleaver as Yosef had seen Cyrus carrying. The third was near a window, still moving, but with his chest soaked in blood. Seeing no one who needed imminent death, Yosef let his blood slowly cool until reason resurfaced and fear. He raced to Mera.
"Are you all right?"
She nodded but didn't speak, her tears turning into a steady stream.
"Aeneas?"
She nodded again and pulled Aeneas slightly higher in her arm so Yosef could see the bottom of his nightshirt and the round hole through several folds of cloth. A ball must have missed Aeneas by the tiniest of margins. Now, Yosef did feel sick, and had to suppress vomiting at the image of a musket or pistol ball hitting the baby's soft skin. Mera nodded a third time toward her parents. Yosef looked over. Breda held Anit. Beautiful, cheerful Anit with so much to look forward to. Had a hole in her forehead. From the size, Yosef's shocked brain attributed the wound to one of the pellets from an attacker's shotgun. Yosef rose, and for a moment, he and Carnegie just stood looking at each other. Yosef wanted to rage and cry at the same time. Carnegie appeared almost gray, the lines in his already lined face now more like chasms. Yosef glanced at Balwas, and only then realized the man was holding closed a serious wound to Sinwin's face. Balwas noticed Yosef's look.
"She saved me," said Balwas. "I just shot one coming through a window when another one came up behind me. Sinwin hit him with a small chair, and he turned and slashed her with a short sword."
Yosef didn't need to ask the fate of the attacker who'd hacked at Sinwin. He recognized the knife handle of Balwas's blade, completely buried in a man's chest. Yosef forced himself to take 3 deep breaths, then spoke aloud to everyone in the room.
"We have to get help.
in case they haven't all gone. And medicines for the wounded.
He hated to lean on Mera, still shocked by the attack and her sister's death, but they had no time.
Mera, give Aeneas and Dwina to Honorant. The men need to stay here.
We need you to get to Kernford for help. Can you do it? She didn't answer, just swallowed, as if ingesting an impossibly big pill.
Carnegie, you stay here. Balwis to me.
We'll see if it's clear out front and we can get a horse from Mera.
Tina, can you take Balwis's place with Sinwin?
What about Y4? Where is he?
Asked Tina.
I don't know, said Yosef. I'm sorry, but we have to send for help before looking for him.
Kales's wife blinked back tears but nodded. Balwis turned Sinwin over to Tina, and Mera handed the babies to Honorant. They couldn't trust any firearm to be loaded, so they took a minute to reload 2 muskets and 4 pistols, giving 2 of the pistols to Mera.
If your family's carriage and horses are all right, you'll use that. If not, we'll see if we can find a horse still tied up out front. We'll lead you to the road in case any attackers haven't left.
We'll also check on the road guard, though I doubt he survived, since he hasn't shown up.
If it's okay that far, go to Kernford for men and medicines.
Yosef grabbed Mera in a fierce hug. Then he and Balwis crept down the hall single file against the wall, Mera following. She spit on the first black-clad body they found. Balwis checked out the front door, then went to the rail. 2 of the horses still remained tied, and the carriage and the 2 horses were under a spreading tree. All of the horses appeared skittish from the gunfire.
I hate sending you alone, Mera, Yosef said, as he gave her a hand up onto the carriage.
Oh, Yosef. Anid. Oh, God.
I know. But right now we have to think of those who need help.
They led the horses toward the road, passing 2 bodies on the way.
We'll check them on the way back, said Yosef. They must be the guard and one of the attackers.
The bodies were the last sign that anything unusual had happened. When they reached the end of the drive, Yosef yelled,
Go!
And Mera used a buggy whip to speed the horses toward Kernford. He wasn't religious, but in such moments, it never hurt to be sure. Please let her be safe from whoever did this and from driving the carriage so hard. She was experienced with horse and carriage, but not at this speed and with the urge to be as fast as possible.
Back to the house, ordered Yosef.
He and Balwis started running, then stopped at the 2 bodies.
This one's dead, said Yosef,
as he checked the body dressed all in black.
The guard is still alive, exclaimed Balwis. I can't see clearly in the dark, but his breath seems strong. Should we take him to the house or leave him here until help comes?
Yosef thought for a moment.
It could be dangerous to move him, but he could also be bleeding to death. I think we have to risk carrying him inside, where we can see how bad he is.
They picked him up, each of them with an arm under the man's back and another arm under a knee. Their adrenaline still flowed, and they hardly felt the weight the 50 yards back to the house. Once inside, they laid him in the hall and began turning up or relighting lanterns. Tina Kales appeared.
Cirrus is helping Sinwin. What about Y4?
She pleaded.
Shit, Yosef thought. I forgot about him.
What about the injured in the great room? Yosef asked. How serious are they?
None are in danger of dying right now. And the dead don't care. What about my husband?
Tina begged.
Balwis and I will find him, Tina. Please check the guard and see if you can help him.
More light came from the great room as lanterns were lit or turned up, illuminating inside the house. Light spilled out the windows, those intact and those broken onto the grounds.
Joseph and Balwas cautiously exited through the enclosed back porch and onto the veranda. Balwas had grabbed a lit lantern and thrown a cloak around it. He set it on the veranda, and once they descended the steps onto the ground, he pulled off the cloak as they knelt. There was no movement as far as the lantern light could cast, and no gunfire.
"There,"
said Balwas, pointing to their left. 30 yards away lay the rear guard, and 30 yards farther was a cluster of bodies. They rose and trotted, backs bent as they scanned while moving. They found Y4 and 3 attackers, one of whom was still alive, as was Kales. His left hand was mangled and his chest and head covered in blood, though whether his or the attacker's they didn't know.
"Let's get him to the house," said Joseph, and they picked up Kales as they had the front guard.
He weighed considerably less than the guard, and they ran to the veranda and through the 2 doors to the foyer. Tina saw them, gave a cry, and left the wounded guard, who now lay moaning. The lanterns cast enough light for them to see Kales's wounds. He had 6 shotgun pellet holes in his left arm and the left side of his chest. Yet from habit, he'd worn a heavy leather coat that had blunted the pellets, which had barely pierced his skin. However, his hand had taken most of the blast, and he was missing 2 fingers. Although none of the wounds were life-threatening, he was unconscious. One of the pellets had struck his forehead with a glancing hit, enough to knock him out, but thankfully hadn't penetrated his skull. Tina cried as she worked on putting a tourniquet on the hand, and Joseph and Balwas left Kales to her and hurried down the hall to the great room. Captain Bekir Usul had no desire to be a martyr. He accepted risks as part of being in the Nathani army and serving on such missions as this one, assigned by Brigadier Zulfa. When the possibility of success in a mission was lost, he saw his duty as surviving to serve and fight again on a later day. The strike's chances of success had always been problematic. Everything had gone well up to the point when a guard and a second man had left the house and walked straight into Usul's men. The attempt to quietly eliminate the 2 men failed and unexpectedly cost 4 of his men. By then, they'd lost the element of surprise, and their only option had been an immediate assault on the house from all sides. Their only chance of killing the hetman and possibly this Kolsko man Havant wanted to include was to overwhelm the people inside before they could react. The unexpectedly stiff defense and his men's disadvantage in having to force the attack had led to short, vicious hand-to-hand fighting, each step of which whittled away at his men's numbers. Usul had led 3 men down the hall toward where they believed most of the defenders had gathered, when an attack from behind surprised them. The single attacker had shot and killed one of his men before they knew he was there, then stabbed another before they could respond. In the semi-darkness and chaos, the ensuing seconds were a blur, but Usul saw his 3rd man fall and fought his own frantic defense against the man who had attacked. Then part of his brain noticed the fighting slacken off in the large room at the end of the hall, all of which convinced him it was time to save what he could, including himself. He disengaged from the islander and fled through a window in a room off the hall. Outside, he called to 2 of his men, one standing next to the window and reloading his musket, the other running from the western side of the house, where he had been stationed to prevent anyone escaping out a window.
"It's Serva,"
Usul said, panting.
"We're leaving."
"The others," a shocked man cried out.
"Gone. Dead or wounded. There's nothing we can do for them. We did our best, and it went to shit. Time to get out."
Usul ran around the bedroom wing of the house to retrace back to where Havant and Driftwich waited. A 4th man joined them, having withdrawn from the eastern side of the house when the fighting died, and it became evident the attempt had failed. Havant knew things hadn't gone well,
instead of hearing 20 attackers simultaneously firing, several sporadic shots could only mean they had been detected early. The following lull and the sounds of fighting that lasted 5 minutes before dying off momentarily gave him optimism. This was quickly dashed when he heard voices from the front of the house, then sounds of a carriage racing toward Kernford, obviously going for help. He wasn't surprised when Usul appeared out of the darkness with only 3 of his 19 men.
"I take it the strike didn't go well,"
Avant said, his voice conveying only information, no emotion or judgment.
"It went to shit," Usul spat. "You said the hitmen would have only 3 guards and Korsko 1 guard. We must have faced more than that, and some were trained and dangerous. One of them killed 3 of my men and alerted the others. I know of another man who killed at least 3 more by himself and almost gutted me before I got out."
Uso's tone just short of accused Avant of incompetence in providing information and planning for the attack. Not that Avant cared. He only dealt with what was, not what he wished. He had already gone over his own options, while waiting to see if any of the strike team returned. They had, so the number of options settled to 3. He could return to Kernford to continue his role and hope Driftwich and the remaining men reached Salford and escape without being captured. Their being killed while fleeing was also acceptable, as long as Avant wasn't compromised. He didn't like that option, because it depended on people and events over which he had no control. The second option that allowed him to continue in Kernford was to eliminate all connections to himself, meaning to kill Driftwich and the 4 surviving team members. The killing didn't bother him, but with 1 against 5, the odds were too great. Avant had a brief moment of regret that all of the men hadn't died in the attempt. He eliminated that option. That left only 1 choice. He would flee with the 5 back to Salford and the waiting sloop.
"I'll be going with you,"
Avant told Driftwich and Usul. "With this few of us, we have plenty of horses. We'll run back to where they're waiting and take 2 each. As planned, we'll burn the first 2 semaphore stations along the road before the line turns away from the Salford road. If we push it, we should reach the signal point before dawn. If it's still dark, I can send a signal to override the captain's reluctance to send a boat ashore, even if the extraction is in daylight." 18 minutes after Mera had left, whipping the carriage horses, a dozen mounted men galloped down the road toward the Korsko house. Half rode bareback, not taking the time to saddle up after Mera had stopped at a pub on the outskirts of Kernford. She'd raced inside, screaming that the hetman had been attacked and needed help at the Korsko house. During the next 30 minutes, more armed men arrived, some riding and some running, including a steady stream of medicants, more armed men, Lewis and Kenrick, and 100 other Keelanders wanting to help in any way they could. It was Kenrick who finally ordered anyone else turned back. The grounds around the Korsko house had filled with so many people and horses, it became too chaotic. Following the first medicants was a fully equipped and staffed MASH unit that had prepared to accompany a training maneuver the next day. The medicants quickly decided to treat all of the wounded in place, instead of first transporting them to the main hospital at St. Tomas. Josef found that he had no duties, except to stay with Mera. Anarind and Gwened took Aeneas, Morwina, and Dwina, Miramel's daughter, to the bedroom wing of the house and away from the turmoil and carnage. Kulch's lower leg was hopeless, having taken most of a shotgun charge. The medicants amputated 2 inches below the knee. Sinwin had received a slash that almost sliced a cheek off her face. Balwas had held the flap of flesh in place until relieved by Tina Balwas. He cursed as he recounted to Yosef how he had to pull out a tooth hanging sideways from Sinewin's wound, so it wouldn't interfere with his holding the wound closed. In other circumstances, Yosef would have been impressed with Balwis's command of cursing, if he hadn't been involved in his own demonstration in both Cadelli and English. Chaos regained consciousness before the medicants arrived. Though in great pain, he worried first about his wife, then about what had happened. Balwis gave him a summary. Carnegie refused to lie down for the medicants until ordered to do so by Gwened before she left with Honorin and the youngest children. The pistol ball wound wasn't serious. His harness was more of a thick leather vest than simply straps. It had absorbed most of the force of 7 shotgun pellets that penetrated Carnegie by no more than an inch. Gwened and Honorin suffered minor injuries, bruises, and a single shotgun pellet to a forearm for Honorin, bruises and a cut on her shoulder from an unknown source for Gwened. Unscathed were Yosef, Mera, Balwis, Cirrus, Breda, and Merit. The final death toll was 6. 3 of the guards, Norlin, Miramel, and Onit.